The Virtual Curbside is brought to you in part by a generous grant from Primary Children's Hospital. Primary Children's Hospital, the child, first and always. The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers. Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. We're very excited to be able to continue our conversation with Aaron Kobernick about food allergies. We learned a lot last week, and we're going to learn even more this week. I should ask you before we get started, are there any conflicts of interest that you should report?
So I have received funding from AstraZeneca, Pfizer, and the National Institutes of Health, none of which are relevant to food allergy.
Okay. So this week, Aaron, we wanted to talk a little bit about diagnosis of food allergies and managing them. First thing, and this is always a big question, who needs allergy testing?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And it's a common question. And I get a lot of referrals and a lot of parents who just come into my office with the question, I think my kid needs allergy testing. I think something's happening here. What I can tell you is the key is history. Okay, so history. That's the best allergy test that we have. If you have a child who, if you get a history that a child eats peanut, is young, is an infant, and it's the first time they've had it, or maybe the first few times they've had it, they have hives on their face, they have some vomiting, they get fussy, that's a patient that is very likely to have peanut allergy and probably needs testing, not only for peanut allergy, but probably for tree nut allergy also, which is present in 30% of kids with peanut allergy. Milk, egg, again, testing should be reserved for kids. To answer that question, the purpose of testing is to figure out if a child has food allergy when you can't figure it out based on history alone. We get into quite a bit of trouble with allergy testing in general, because it is the rate of false positive is very high. Okay. So in kids with eczema, for example, and this has actually been studied.
That's not insignificantly intrusive either, is it? Because you're asking people if you're telling them that they're allergic to something they haven't noticed before, you're asking them to change the way they eat.
Absolutely. So what we see, if you were to take a bunch of kids with eczema who tolerate a robust diet and a variety of different foods and just do skin testing on them and blood IgE testing on them, you would find positive tests to a variety of foods probably about half of kids. And for that reason, there's been kind of a movement to educate pediatricians and allergists and make sure that we're not over-testing these kids. Because again, you have a kid, and this is something that I hear very commonly in clinic. I have a patient, mom says, well, I'm wondering if my child has a milk allergy or a peanut allergy, because I've heard that's really common. Well, has the child ever had a reaction? No, he eats peanut butter sandwiches every day, but I'm wondering, is it an allergy I'm not seeing? Does the child have eczema? Yeah, he has terrible eczema. If I test that kid and for a variety of allergens, and then we end up with some positive tests, mom's then not really going to know what to do with that information. And quite frankly, neither am I. So the testing should really be targeted. And every time you do a test, I mean, this is true in all of medicine, but especially when harm can result as a result of a false positive test, anytime you do a test, you really have to ask yourself, what question am I trying to answer? And is this the best way to answer the question? And what am I going to do if I see a false positive result? Because that could be potentially detrimental to the family. Ultimately, the gold standard for food allergy testing is a food challenge. So if we have a patient and the history is not entirely clear, the testing hasn't solved the issue for us, and we're still not sure if that child has a food allergy, we do something called an oral food challenge. This is where we bring the kid into clinic and we essentially feed them in graded amounts. We feed them more and more over a period of 1 to 4 hours, depending on the level of risk that we think there is. And then we see if the child reacts. This is in many ways playing with fire. When I was a a fellow at UNC. So I trained at the University of North Carolina, where we are one of the major food allergy study centers in terms of studying treatment of food allergy. And every child had to have, who we had enrolled in a study, would have to have an entry challenge, meaning you have a kid who has peanut allergy, but you have to prove it before they go in the study. And so we would do these food challenges. You feed a kid with peanut allergy peanut. And, you know, I explain this to my wife and she says, that sounds completely crazy. But that's what we do. We feed them and then we do the food challenge. They react. We give them epinephrine. We kind of bring them back. And then we've confirmed that they have food allergy. It sounds totally crazy, but when we think about it, it is. But, you know, this is how these studies are done, because the last thing we want is to enroll kids who don't have peanut allergy. And it's the same thing. The last thing we want to do in clinic is send a kid out not knowing if they have peanut allergy. We want to know. And because even if it's only 20% of kids, we can really rule that out. Well, for those kids, if they don't have to carry an EpiPen and avoid peanut, their life has changed substantially.
Yeah. So in short, then, you would test somebody who's had a reaction. And you would do relatively limited testing. Is that right? That there are some things. So if somebody has reacted to peanuts, you would probably test for tree nuts.
Yep.
Would you expect beyond that?
Yeah. So about 30% of kids with peanut allergy will have a tree nut allergy also. And that's important to identify before parents, because it's a common question. And before I send a parent home telling them their child has peanut allergy, I want to also know, do they have almond allergy, or is that going to be okay?
But the issue of tree nuts is not super specific, right? Because almonds are different from cashews, are different from walnuts. There's not a tree nut antigen.
Correct. So we test for a variety of tree nuts. So almond kind of stands alone. Cashew and pistachio tend to be very cross-reactive. Walnut and pecan tend to be very cross-reactive. And then we also test for, you know, occasionally things like Brazil nut. You know, seed allergy is something that's becoming much more common, sesame seeds in particular. And that's something that we know much less about when we get talking, you know, when we get to talking about allergen. So we've got the numbers worked out pretty well for associations between peanut and tree nut allergy, less so for seeds, which are becoming more common, like I said.
And what's the difference between between blood testing and skin testing? Is there a role?
So great question. Yeah, so great question. So both are quite sensitive, but not terribly specific. So in short, skin testing is considered to be more effective in that it gives you an idea of the in vivo response. Okay, so when I poke you with peanut extract, that tells me very clearly what your body does with peanut, okay? Now the blood test, the way that it's called an immunocap assay, and the way that test is designed, the way it works is they take a bead and they coat the bead with peanut. And then the peanut is then assayed with the patient's serum. And if there is IgE in the patient's serum, it will obviously bind to the peanut. It's then washed off. And then a tag that binds the end of the IgE is essentially introduced. That tag is an antibody and it has a tag on it, which fluoresces. So that's how it's detected. Now, anything else that is IgE and that will cross-react and bind peanut will also light up that test. So say you have a patient with a grass allergy. So if this is an older kid who has sensitization to grass pollen, well, grass pollen, the protein that is active in grass pollen is very similar to the protein in the legume that is peanut. And so there can be cross-reactivity. That test, that blood test can light up. So this is a long way of saying that if people have pollen allergy, they can make IgE that is very similar to peanut IgE, and you can see false positive tests. It's also worth noting that we see cross-reactivity among different nuts. So again, a child with a peanut allergy may have a peanut IgE of greater than 100, and some of that peanut IgE just binds the almond protein when we do a blood test. So again, we can see false positives in the blood test all the time. Another, suffice it to say that cross-reactivity creates problems with the blood test. The other issue is that kids with eczema, they make IgE to like everything, okay? So if you ever get a blood test, and we've all kind of been there, and you know, I think when people get that blood test report back, they think to themselves, I am never ordering that blood test again because this is a mess. You know, you have a child who drinks milk every day, but they have a milk IgE that's 4.5 and they're peanut and they're, you know, they're all through the roof. Those kids, they'll have an IgE, a total IgE of 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 commonly. And they make IgE to everything. So
to be clear with those patients, if they are not having reactions that are noticeable, but there's something on the test, are we doing harm if we have those kids continue to consume that antigen?
Potentially. So it's a great question. So for very young children who have blood testing early and let's say a milk protein shows up, and this has actually been studied also, let's say milk IgE shows up and you recommend avoidance, even though the child has been consuming that food, I believe it's 15 to 20% of those kids will eventually develop an allergy if they avoid the food. So some of those kids, you can actually turn allergic by recommending avoidance. It has to be the perfect storm. We don't know what creates that perfect storm entirely, but it's a way to do harm. And for that reason, panel-wide food allergy testing is not recommended.
Actually, the opposite of what we've often done is say, maybe you ought to avoid that. But maybe they ought to be eating more of it to not develop an allergy.
What we've learned is that keeping foods, a robust number of foods, a nice balanced diet is tremendously important.
Very interesting. So are some food allergies categorically more dangerous than others? Are there some antigens that are just, or is that not a thing? To just be guided by the patient's clinical experience.
So it sounds like the question here is about severity of reaction, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, so there are a few factors that predict severity of reaction, and it's not necessarily the type of food, so interestingly. So it tends to be age, tends to be a really strong predictor of severity, and presence or absence of uncontrolled asthma. What do I mean by that? Well, all the foods are capable of inducing a life-threatening reaction or a life-ending reaction. Okay, so any food allergy, anytime. I mean, that's something that parents fear and they have to live with. Now, the odds of that happening, of a child dying from a food allergy, from an allergic reaction, are far lower than the rates of, you know, kids dying from injuries and car accidents and things like even suicide. You know, it's not likely that a child is going to die from food allergy. Okay, so I try and explain to parents that, well, yes, your child can die and any exposure can do it, but at the same time, you're going to take the precautions, you're going to make sure you don't eat the food, you're going to carry your EpiPen, you're going to do that. Now, a couple words about severity. So kids who are at highest risk tend to be adolescents with uncontrolled asthma. Okay, that we know. Younger kids, you almost never hear about, you never hear about a baby, an infant dying of a food allergy. It just doesn't happen. They tend to throw up and get hives. But as kids get older, the reactions tend to intensify. Other factors that may play a role. So how much of the allergen did you consume? That is tremendously important. So eating a peanut butter sandwich is far different from having a fleck of peanut in your Thai food that was supposed to not have peanut in it. They can both cause reactions. They can both be severe. They can both be life-threatening. But when a really big dose of the allergen is much more likely to cause a life-threatening reaction. Things like how much food is in your stomach at the time you eat it seem to matter. So again, very small exposures with a full stomach tend to be less intense of a reaction, or to lead to less intense of a reaction than an amount of food on an empty stomach. Even things like, do you have a cold? Is your immune system revved up? They can, again, presence of immunologic kind of reactivity or revving up can intensify food allergic reactions.
Let me ask you a couple of questions about coming back to cross-reactivity. So we talked a little bit about associations. Let me just talk about a couple of other sort of broader associations. There are some people who are allergic to some pollens who get an itchy throat with some fruits. Is that worrisome?
So yeah, tremendously fascinating. It's called oral allergy syndrome or food pollen syndrome. And this is where, just like we said, reactivity to grass pollen. Also, that IgE also is slightly reactive to things like fruits, vegetables, legumes. And this is not necessarily worrisome, though, to answer your question. So these almost never lead to an anaphylactic reaction. an EpiPen is not required. Oftentimes, I see these patients in clinic, and what we can do for them is look at their environmental allergy and try and fix that, which sometimes helps with the issues they're having with food. But it's tremendously bothersome. These patients can't eat a salad. They really can't eat fruit. They just don't want to. But it's not worrisome in the sense that it's going to kill them.
Do antihistamines help with that? If somebody wants to eat a cantaloupe, would taking an antihistamine help?
Plus minus. I mean, some patients find that they get some relief. I've even had patients who swish around Benadryl, or we've had patients who like a liquid Benadryl. We've had patients who have swished around gatcromelin also, which is something we've tried. And sometimes that helps, but not uniformly. And usually patients just say, you know what, it's just not worth it to me. It's fine.
Is there a ranch dressing with Benadryl?
Right. I think you're onto something there.
What about if I'm allergic to one thing from a species, will I be allergic to other stuff? So if I'm milk allergic, am I going to be allergic to beef?
No, so absolutely not. There is one instance in which people have a strange allergy to mammalian meat, and we see it only essentially in the southeastern United States, and now even in the northeastern United States, in the area where a specific deer tick is present. And I don't know, we don't see it at all in Utah. Oh, so yeah. I don't know how much you want me to talk about that, but that is, it's a tremendously fascinating allergy where patients end up being sensitized to mammalian meat after getting a tick bite. And the idea is that the tick has meat in its stomach, bites the human, and you make an IgE response. So the meat of any mammal ends up causing a reaction. Now it's different from a typical food allergy. It's adult onset. Well, it's an onset whenever you're bitten. The reaction is different. With food allergy, we see immediate reaction. So you eat the food, you eat peanut, you react. It's within minutes, you know, half hour tops, maybe an hour, but it's usually really fast. With this, you eat the food and you don't react for 4 to 6 hours. So the typical story is I'm out at a barbecue, I ate some sausage, I woke up in the middle of the night throwing up with hives all over my body. Very strange. Some of those patients also don't tolerate milk. So suffice it to say, it's not in Utah.
Well, that's just fascinating. One other question. So as I was reading up a little bit for this, apparently there's a fair amount of cross-reactivity with different species milks. So if you're milk allergic, am I going to be goat's milk allergic too? Or?
Yeah, you know, typically what I tell patients is just avoid them all. We could do food allergy. We could do food challenges and look at goat's milk, but most patients will react. And as you know, parents tend to worry a lot about, well, my child's not going to get any milk. How is he or she going to grow? Well, listen, it's really not necessary. The calcium's everywhere. You're going to be fine. Right. Vitamin D's everywhere. So once we have that conversation, usually things are fine.
I did read that there's less reactivity to mare's milk and donkey milk. And I'm just wondering if Whole Foods is carrying donkey milk now.
Yeah, you know what, Paul? I do not know the answer to that question.
Well, we'll try to figure that out. So who should have injectable epinephrine?
So that's a great question. So when I talk to parents about this, and this tends to be a question that every parent asks, and if they don't bring it up, then I bring it up. So when do I use the EpiPen? The way I've always described this is any symptoms from the chin down. So vomiting, hives all over the body, my throat hurts, my throat swelling, difficulty breathing, even coughing, which is an early sign of wheezing. EpiPen should be administered. Now, the way I like to think about administration of epinephrine is that it's not really a medication that needs to be reserved for life-threatening reactions only. It's a medication that's tremendously safe, that's fairly easy to administer, although parents are terrified to do it, and we try and coach them as much as we can. But it will make the child feel better in minutes. I mean, if you see how terrible kids feel when they're having these reactions, and then you give them Epi, and 3 minutes later they're back to normal and they're playing and they're, you know, opening every drawer in the exam room again. You know, this is exactly what we want to see. So it works fast. It's epinephrine. It's just not going to hurt anyone at those doses. And it really, once you give it and you see how well it works, it becomes much less scary to give, and it becomes really an easy medication to recommend to parents. Now, I get a lot of parents who say, well, you know, it wasn't that bad of a reaction, so I just gave Benadryl and things worked out fine. Well, things may have worked out fine, and that's fine. But the problem is, There's something about early administration of epinephrine that really stabilizes mast cells. So that, again, a common thread, every year our academy kind of goes through fatal reactions and says, well, what happened? And we try and figure it out. And late administration of epinephrine is a reasonably common thread. So that even when you give that, for whatever reason, once those mast cells have released that dramatic amount of histamine, it's very difficult to recover from. So I say give it early, give it. If you ever are asking yourself, should I give the EpiPen? The answer is yes, just give it.
And once I've given it, is that the end of the story? Should I do anything after I've given it?
So this is a very common question also. You know, but if I give the EpiPen, I have to go to the ER, right? Well, okay, we don't have to do anything, but it may be in your best interest to go to the ER, and here's why. So the vast majority of the time, you give the EpiPen and things resolve. Now, the problem, as you know, is there can be a second phase to the reaction. Some of these reactions are biphasic, so that when the epinephrine wears off, and this could be in 30 minutes or this could be in 4 hours, depending on a variety of factors, we can see kind of the reaction recur. Now, typically, that second phase is not as bad as the first phase, okay? So for most people, okay, you know, my kid had some hives on the body and coughed. I gave the EpiPen, they felt better. And then it's very unlikely that that kid's going to then come back in 4 hours and have this dramatic, hypotensive, you know, life-threatening reaction. But it is possible. About 15 to 20% of kids who have allergic reactions will have kind of a second phase and require a second dose of epinephrine. It's not no one, it's enough kids so that we worry. And what I tell parents is, you know, and we've all seen it. I gave the EpiPen, then I went to the ER and I sat there and they did nothing for me. I sat in a room and I waited and they sent me home and I got this huge bill. And that is far and away the most common thing that is going to happen in the ER. The problem is we just don't know who is gonna progress into a more severe reaction. Quite frankly, I have some parents who go to the ER and sit in the parking lot and they just wait there, who have kind of been through reactions before, which I don't think is unreasonable. I certainly can't advocate that approach, but I don't think it's unreasonable. But you know, I think that the truth really lies somewhere in the middle. You know, our recommendation has to be both, you know, in the interest of safety and reasonably practical. So I tell parents exactly what I just told you. And I said, yes, my recommendation is you go to the emergency room, you get looked at, you get checked out. But the most likely thing that's going to happen is they're going to send you home.
Two other quick questions. Are there other kids who need a second dose of epinephrine at home, who need a second injection?
Yeah. So again, about 15 to 20% of kids will require a second injection. And it depends on how it's dosed. So one common, and I can talk about dosing for a minute. So dosing really should be, we like to dose 0.1 per kilo. And so one problem we get into is with the EpiPen juniors, which are 0.15 milligrams, you know, when do you escalate the dose? So for example, you have a kid who's 10 kilos or 15 kilos, 10 to 15 kilos, that's a perfectly adequate dose. But as soon as that kid's 16 kilos, you're underdosing. And certainly as they get to 20 kilos, you're really underdosing, but they're not necessarily ready for that 0.3. And I'll just, you know, again, my practice and the practice that we used at the Food Allergy Study Center at the University of North Carolina was to switch kids over at 20 kilograms to the higher dose. Much less likely that kids are going to need a second dose if the first dose is adequate.
Any hints on how to help families get this? I mean, it's often fairly expensive these days to get injectable epinephrine.
Yeah, so this is a problem. And currently we have found a mail order pharmacy through AviQ that they ship it to the family's house with no copay. So for commercially insured patients. So that's great. That's been a problem lately, and so we're running into this again, but this is a problem.
Well, we would hate to solve everything in one fell swoop.
That's right.
All right. Well, again, fascinating. So next week we're gonna tackle the whole idea that really is kind of a leap forward, because what we're talking about here is diagnosis and management. But next week we're gonna talk a little bit about the idea of can you fix food allergies. So stay tuned. I suspect people won't breathe for the next week, waiting to hear what you have to say about that. Thanks for your time, Aaron. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.